Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to Non-Commercial Community Radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to community radio, KBOO 90.7.
Hello, I'm Jeff Van Trees, and this is Mobilize News. We welcome you to our show, as our guest today is Christian Stahlberg. Christian is the founder of an organization called Natural Intelligence, and you can see it on the scroll at the bottom of your screen. It's naturalintelligence.us, not .com or .org. There's a bunch of other natural intelligence URLs that are not related to Christian's organization, so just want to make that clear if you go visit it. So Christian has done a lot of work on localization and empowering local communities. And it's a real pleasure to have you on the show today. So thank you so much for joining us today, Christian.
Thank you for having me here.
So can you tell us a little bit about natural intelligence, what it means, and what inspired you to start this organization?
Sure. Well, natural intelligence really refers to the genius of nature, the 3.8 billion years of evolutionary intelligence and perfection, if you will. I have a background in biomimicry, and so that's all brought me to where I'm focusing my attention these days, which is the arena of localization as a response to the problems inherent in globalization in our world, particularly in the light of climate change.
You know, that's really interesting, because we think of climate change as more or less a global problem that requires, certainly does require a global solution, but we've seen, we cover COP pretty consistently on this show. That is the Conference of Parties for the United Nations, and we've often been disappointed. There was some progress last year, but what is your thoughts on the United Nations or these international organizations that have often been accused of not taking into account local concerns, especially when we're talking about indigenous communities and low-income communities around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, essentially, there's been so many COPs, and essentially it's the most powerful of the world that are in control, and essentially controlling its directionality and the limitations, if you will, of what they do and do not care to talk about. And, you know, it's a big topic, but essentially we're looking at the regulation of business as usual. So the continuation of globalization, the continuation of capitalism, economism as the hegemony in which we all live and live our lives. And it's a huge problem because the effects of climate chaos and disruption instability are mounting, and the evidence is all around us. There's discussion about adaptation and mitigation. And in my opinion, that needs to happen at the local level.
And when we say local level, you know, what does that mean exactly? Does that mean community organizations? Does it mean community elected officials? What is the local level in that sense?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It kind of depends on the context. Localization can be your neighborhood, it can be your municipality, it could be your state or department, or it could be your nation, or it could even be a region, a cluster of nations. It just depends. But the ultimate goal here is resilience, self-reliance, and self-sufficiency, and taking measures to address the vulnerability that's inherent in our globalized world. I mean, you have a perfect example where the war in Ukraine has caused problems in Africa. And so that's a poster child, if you will, of where globalization has taken us in this world, where it's the creation of extreme vulnerabilities and the loss of control of people of where they live and what happens to them.
You know, we've had a lot of guests on this show, including those that have been nominated for Right Livelihood. Let me start that over again. We've had a lot of guests on this show that have done a lot of community activism. Some have even received Right Livelihood awards, like Sokoka Sola, which emphasized the ability for local communities to produce their own food and produce their own products and sell it at rates much below market value. We've also had people, like you mentioned, in Africa. We've had a guest on from Uganda that was organizing against the East African crude oil pipeline, where people are literally being thrown off their land in order to build a pipeline without compensation. And there's just so many examples of this that we've seen, of people's rights being trampled over. And it seems to be pretty consistently the result of a lack of mobilization, or perhaps an impossibility of mobilization. It's very difficult for local communities that are spread out thousands of miles apart from each other to coalesce towards a common interest, even if they have a common interest. By contrast, you can have multinational corporations that can focus power and wealth and are able to sort of divide and conquer the rest of the world. So it would appear that there must also be a mobilization of these local interests in order to really stand up against the powers that are otherwise oppressing them.
Yes, absolutely. What we're seeing really is more transnational and global networking, and the creation of networks of solidarity by people around the world that are working in their local communities where they live to bring about the necessary changes, to bring about reductions in vulnerability, taking control of their own environments and what happens to them, and to not be buffeted around by the whims of the market, if you will, and capitalism and globalization. So, while the movement is local, it is also global, because people are sharing their information and knowledge about their successes and lessons learned, and building a movement, a localization movement, which extends from the grassroots up. And there are even some initiatives being brought to sovereign states, like, for example, in Wales, around issues of well-being and the importance of local control.
Yeah, and we think about, you mentioned, you said, where was that located, the last place?
Wales.
Okay. So, you know, we think of communities like Wales or in Europe, or places that are not necessarily as vulnerable as, let's say, some of the low-lying countries that might be in the South Pacific, or places that are going to be hit very quickly by climate change. Also, there's lack of economic resources in a lot of these areas, certainly sub-Saharan Africa. And it becomes you know, is it possible for activists in these areas to mobilize? Certainly one of the great privileges that we have living in a superpower first world country, whether it's United States or Europe or Australia or anywhere else, is that, you know, we have this thing called the First Amendment here in the States. There's versions of that elsewhere. But we have this thing that sort of allows us to be seen, to be heard, even if we're not, don't have access to the government or whatever the power structure is. But especially in other parts of the world, those voices can literally be just killed. I mean, people can be either killed or be thrown off their property because these are not robust democracies. How do we reach out to people in these countries and these communities in order to empower them?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Jeff. Well, I think we need to try to get certain agencies, like perhaps some of the agencies of the United Nations and some of the other multilateral organizations around the world that invest in development activities. And I also think working with the educational system, it's going to take a multi-pronged approach, really, to bring together the knowledge and the guidance and the technical wherewithal, and to get it distributed and into the hands of people in their localities so that they can have the capacity and be resourced to bring about the changes they will want to bring about, so as to have greater control over the essentials of their lives, whether it's housing, food, energy, and so on. And a term I always like to bring up in regards to this is appropriate technology, because you know, there's a lot of high tech and a lot of dependencies, and of course therefore vulnerabilities around the sourcing or procurement of high technology solutions, which where there are supply chain disruptions or failures due to climate chaos, that can leave people extremely vulnerable and incapacitated. And that's why there needs to be a new focus on the principles behind appropriate technology, which is something that came out of the 1970s, if you will, where people, one of the best examples was where a fellow that actually won a MacArthur Prize, he was building wheelchairs in the developing world out of basic things that he could find. As you know, wheelchairs could be very expensive. So he was building them from scrap or waste throwaway materials. And that's the kind of thinking.
You know, and you think about how there's such a linkage between the free flow of information and democracy, and how, whether it's, you think of a dictator, let's say like in North Korea or Putin in Russia or wherever else, part of the reason that they're able to stay in power is that they can brainwash their citizens, and they can do that by controlling access to information. And so something that we have here, we sometimes take for granted, is that we can get pretty much any information from anywhere, and it's relatively uncensored if we go out and look for it. Certainly the government isn't censoring. There might be other forms of censorship. But getting to your point, as far as having access to broadband, access to the internet, so that people can know what's going on elsewhere in the world and become aware of a lot of these issues, if that's lacking, then it's really hard to get anything off the ground if people are kept ignorant. In many cases, they're kept purposefully ignorant, and they're not able to really understand their place in the world and what they can do.
Yes, this is why it's so important to support the subaltern movement, if you want to call it that, of real education that empowers people and gives them the news and information that they need to be empowered in their lives and not be so vulnerable. And of course, the internet itself is a highly centralized, becoming more centralized. It started out as a cooperative venture. There's some elements of that, but as you know, some of the big multinationals have worked very hard to try to get LastPass where it could be fully privatized, which is a real danger. And so there's a movement now with the free flow of the microelectronics revolution, if you will, and the reduction in prices of creating an infosphere, which is different than the highly centralized one that we regard as the internet today. And it's more, again, it's more localized. So you're seeing localized information systems popping up, almost akin to what the bulletin boards were like before the centralized internet took off in the 90s. And it allows for more decentralization. It allows for more democracy and quality control of the information so as to avoid the mass of dis and misinformation that we're seeing on the internet, which borders on psychological operations, whether it's coming from the state or multinationals today.
It's really interesting. What should we be advocating for here, here in the United States, to increase a local voices, local control around the world, or localization around the world? What should we be doing here? What type of bills or policies should we be advocating for?
Yes. Well, I think experimenting with peer-to-peer networking, developing local information systems, is a good start. As more and more of that is done, more and more technology will be available and hopefully come down in price. Cooperatives can be set up. The idea is to get away from the psychological operations and the extreme control of the people, if you will, from the state and or large multinational corporations, all of which is maintaining business as usual on the status quo, and disallowing us, we the people, to bring about the transformational change that we all know we must have, but are rendered helpless in order to bring it about. So we have to take power and take advantage of the microelectronics and telecommunications revolution.
You know, to that point, if we think back to 30 or 40 years ago, or even go further back, there would just be a handful of stations before cable TV that people had access to. If you go back to the 60s or early 70s, there were only so many places that you could get news. Now we have cable news, and we have YouTube channels, and there's other social media that people can get information from. But like you said, they can also get misinformation as well. But what is your sort of on hold? What use of social, or how do you think social media has really sort of fundamentally changed the way that that local stories can potentially get a wider audience? Because that's something that never really existed before.
Yeah, you raise a really interesting question, and there's a lot of pundits exploring this and talking about it today, and I'm not an expert on it by any means, but it seems to me that the thrust today is really segmentation, identification of particular audiences. And because so many audience, because of the power of technology and the ability to have so many channels and segmentation, they're essentially creating echo chambers of audiences, across the political spectrum. And essentially, it's an isolating exercise. I tend to think of it as weapons of mass distraction. We've all heard about the amount of dissent and conflict that social media can bring about, which attracts eyeballs, right? Raising people's vitriol, people wanting to jump in and fight. And so this all goes back to psychological operations. I tend to think of it as weapons of mass distraction by the state and or multinationals, and people are falling for it. We're all being victimized by this. And with arguably the decline in critical thinking capabilities that we can thank our educational system for, people are falling into this trap, and it's a no-win situation. And again, this is where, in my view, only at the local level, at the community level, can we have these conversations and these realizations and build from the ground up an infosphere and a place of discourse that is rational and logical and with an emphasis on critical thinking and problem solving and solution building.
Yeah, if we think about like the the train derailment in East Palestine some weeks back. That was an example of where there was zero local, not only not no local control, there was no information that the people that were living there even had to take the appropriate remediative steps. And so, for example, one of the things that they could have done was start buying bottled water. They could have evacuated the community. They really didn't know what that train was carrying until sometime later. And we really still don't know everything that that train was carrying. And it really brings up a question, and people can argue about whether this is a matter of interstate commerce for which the states would or might not have the ability to stop a train from carrying these items because it's necessary for interstate commerce. Somebody could certainly make that argument, but there really is no argument as to why local communities are kept in the dark as to what toxic substances are being shipped through their community. There's just no legitimate reason why to keep them in the dark for that, other than that if that information were to get out, it would cause bad public relations, and that's not a legitimate reason. So this is a real fox in the hen house situation when we have industry essentially writing laws through having well over 1,000 lobbyists for the railroad companies that are in Washington, and that it's not a coincidence that the fact that they get to keep their inventory secret from everyone else that's potentially could be harmed or killed by the chemicals that are released in the event that you have a train derailment like what we saw.
Yeah, no, it's another poster child, if you will, about the mess that we've gotten ourselves into, where economism rules the day, and it's all about damage control and concerns around legal liability for toxic contamination and poisoning of people and planet. It's just a horrible mess. I mean, our governments are essentially taken over by the economy, and that's the only consideration. And so, again, this is where in localization, for me, local governments and the ability to bring about real democracy is absolutely essential, because otherwise the situation, by contrast today, we're all just being messaged by the state and or the financial special interests that control our government, and we're rendered helpless. And even when you have entities like state and federal environmental protection and regulating agencies, they've also been completely co-opted for the most part. And so we've really gotten ourselves into a huge mess, and that's why the change must be transformational to bring about real democracy.
And what's the first step for that? Like we said earlier in the episode here, mobilizing is very difficult. That's actually why our show is called Mobilize. We think, you know, mobilizing is such a critical piece. But you actually look at these different communities that are facing these challenges, whether it's in East Palestine, Ohio, whether it's those encountering the wildfires and out in California, or people here in Florida that are concerned with red tide or algal blooms. It's all related to the same inherent failures in the system, which is that we have a pay-to-play political system where the interests of the general public are always going to be ignored. So it's almost like we have to bring them together. We have to bring these local interests together in order to speak with a common voice, because otherwise we're all just kind of fragmented doing our own thing, and we don't have a common voice or a common leadership that is representing all of us at the same time.
Absolutely. It's interesting. I have a background in disaster work, having worked for local state and federal government, responding to disasters, both man-made and what you might call natural, which in fact are really not natural in the first place because of human habitat design. That's a whole other conversation. But the phenomena that we find is that when there's a disaster in the immediate aftermath, people will get together and help one another and have conversations where they would not ever otherwise have those conversations. And particularly today, with all of the atomization and the segmentation and the partisanship and just the divide and conquer, if you will, through the psychological operations of the state and or multinationals and large corporations, in the name of profit and control. We just don't have any contact with anyone else except the choir, people who are just like us. Well, that's a disaster in and of itself. And that is a failure of democracy. And that's where the notion of people's assemblies comes into play. Extinction Rebellion in the UK is talking about that as one of their three major demands. It's extremely important to bring people together once again, because we are so far from that anymore. But we need each other, and we got to work together at the local level to bring about the solutions for our lives.
Do we have any examples of this working successfully that we can look at as a template for future efforts at localization?
Oh, there absolutely are. In fact, one I can just call out, I just saw the other day, there was a really interesting film by Extinction Rebellion talking about their third demand, people's assemblies. And the video was around, well, what is a people assembly? What is the benefit of it? What does it mean? So I would encourage people to look that up. But interestingly, in that segment that Extinction Rebellion did, they had an excerpt from a project that was filmed by CNN called America in One Room. And it was very interesting. It was done a few years ago, and they got people in a local community from all across the spectrum of political, ethnic, and you name it, and got them all together in one room for several days talking about major issues. And it was really interesting how beneficial that was. And it's just light years from where we find ourselves today, thanks to the psychological operations.
And it's, you have to get them in the room, and you know, but the negotiation has to be above board in some sense. And what we saw with the last, you know, just utter embarrassment within the House of Representatives, the election of the Speaker of the House, where you just have these interests that have no business in the room, right? So, I mean, it's one thing to have negotiation amongst legitimate stakeholders, but there's certain things that really are just illegitimate and shouldn't be on the table. And so certainly when it comes to electing a House Speaker, whether Fox News gets footage of January 6th, that shouldn't even be on the table. That's just totally illegitimate and just erodes any faith in the system entirely. So they're almost, it's important to have negotiation, have everyone at the table, but there's certain things that are either being asked for or certain people that are in the negotiations that really shouldn't be there at all.
Absolutely. And you know, this brings up, we could have a whole show on the topic of the vulnerability of statism and the condition of representative democracies where we find ourselves today. This is why you're hearing more and more about people's assemblies and direct democracy. And you know, this is something that can only happen at a local scale, if you will. Because the opportunities for corruption and co-optation are just so excessive, and we're surrounded by the evidence of that. And so, you know, I would pick a local people's assembly over deciding our fate locally over what's happening in Washington and Congress any day of the week.
Yeah, I certainly would agree with that. For people that, you know, like, you know, let me start that over. So for those that want to, you know, take the let's do it one more time. So for those that want to get involved, want to have a local voice and participate in localization, if they're looking for a first step, how to get from A to B, what would you tell them to do?
Yeah, there's a wonderful organization called Local Futures that I would direct people to. And they're all about localization, and it's a worldwide organization where people are sharing news and information and lessons learned about activities in their communities. And so that's one place I would direct people to. So yeah, and if you just look up localization, you'll come across resources that speak to it. But I would I think starting with local futures would be a really good place to start. And they have a lot of online information, publications, and talks. The founder, Helena Norbert Hodge, has given a number of talks, and you can find those on YouTube, and there will be links to that on the Local Futures website. And also a lot of networking taking place where people are sharing information transnationally, globally, about their efforts around localization, whether it be food sovereignty or local energy, conservation, ecosystem restoration, so on and so forth.
Excellent. We'll definitely check that out. We are just about out of time, so I really want to thank you, Christian, for joining us today and sharing your story about increasing the power of localization.
Thank you, Jeff. My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Check him out again. So thanks so much again, Christian. Check him out at naturalintelligence.us. Check us out at mobilize.news. Thank you so much, everyone.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hello, I'm Jeff Antrees, and this is Mobilize News. We welcome you to our show, as our guest today is Jamie Arbib. Jamie rejoins us. He's the co-founder of RethinkX, which is a nonprofit organization that does work all around the world, looking at what we call disruptive technology that will disrupt our current unsustainable technology and lead us towards a more sustainable future. So, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here.
So, a lot to talk about. One of the things, and just kind of looking from a 1,000-foot view, that your organization looks at is trying to sort of break us out of the sort of mental limitations that we might have on the idea of changing our technology or changing our infrastructure. And what are some of those changes that really need to come soon and that we really need to wrap our minds around, whether we're talking about electrification of vehicles, public transportation, and so forth?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, Jeff. But I mean, really, you know, what we see happening is a transformation of our system of production, right? So human civilization really has been in a kind of model of production now for, I mean, probably 10,000 years, but, you know, obviously massively accelerated through the industrial period, which is based on kind of the extraction and exploitation of scarce resources, right? I mean, the inputs into our system, you know, materials, labor, capital, and so on, are all scarce, right? And that drives a kind of competitive environment, right? It's a kind of world of exploit or get exploited, grow or be outgrown, right? And we've seen that through the pattern of history, that civilizations have grown, they've expanded, they've consumed others. You know, those societies that have tried to live sustainably, tried to live within their means, and we've had plenty of them in the past. They've been left behind. They've been overtaken by others who in their expansion have kind of taken them over. Because that's really the underlying dynamic of our current system, right? It encourages growth. If you don't grow, you get outcompeted. And we've seen over the course of history that play out. We're now in a situation where we have a kind of, almost a global winner that's kind of expanded through both conquest and imitation, essentially. But it's ultimately unsustainable. Extraction and exploitation of both people and planet are kind of the essence of the system, right? So, what we see emerging on the other side is a suite of new technologies that enable a fundamentally different production system. And you can't understand that system that's emerging by looking at the old. So if we think of energy, for instance, we're in a world, we have a system that, you know, Thomas Edison would recognize, right, in terms of the infrastructure, the basis of the technology, the business model, the value chain, right, based on kind of centralized, grand-scale fossil fuel production. What's emerging in the energy space is a new paradigm based on solar, wind, and batteries.
Seeking answers and
those
having
technologies
some
technologies are modular. They're scalable in a way that
7
the old,
p.m. on the 4th.
The old aren't. So you know, supply can scale all the way down to demand. You can have solar that just powers a mobile phone in a way that you can't do with a fossil fuel power station. And the inputs into that system are available everywhere in abundance. So we have scarce supplies of oil and coal and gas, and that kind of affects, you know, the need to secure those supplies, a kind of centralization, command and control that defines the current system. In the new system, that goes away. Right? Those things, are photons, electrons, and so on, are available everywhere in the world, you know, in abundance. So we end up with a totally different system with totally different properties. I think Buckminster Fuller once said, you know, there's nothing about a caterpillar that tells you it's going to become a butterfly. And that's kind of a useful analogy for thinking about what's emerging. We have this old system, the caterpillar. And within it is emerging the new system, this butterfly. And yet all we do is understand the caterpillar in great detail. We can't possibly understand what's emerging if our mind is trapped in that old paradigm, in that old system. So we have our minds in the box of the old, and we see all the problems with that old system. The environmental degradation leads to climate change and all kinds of other environmental problems. We see inequality, we see other social issues, poverty and so on, that exist within that old paradigm. And when we try to solve those problems, what we're essentially doing is putting band-aids on that old system, right? We're trying to make the old system less bad. And that's fine in the short term, but we mistake these band-aids for solutions. Now, if we step back and we look at this system shift that we're seeing, this change in paradigm, in the paradigm of production, we can see this butterfly, this new system emerging within that old system. And those problems go away, right? Then no longer is it, you know, exploitation of people and planet, you know, inequality, environmental degradation, no longer are they the essence of the system, right? That all falls away. And so really the biggest challenge that we see for humanity in navigating this path is understanding what's emerging, understand that there is a better world that's coming, but it's going to feel incredibly destabilizing and bumpy because that old system that we've known, and it's all we know, is breaking down. Right, and we see the incumbents within that old system, whether they're in politics, whether they're in business, whether they're in finance, desperately trying to hold on to the old, trying to hold on to what they had, resisting change. And we as individuals resist change because we find it terrifying. We find it scary. We fear for our jobs. We fear for what's coming. We fear for our communities because we can see how they're going to be transformed. But we don't have a vision, a better vision of what's coming, to hang on to inspire us, to allow us to kind of hold the course as we go through this incredible transformation.
And what is coming? What should we be looking forward to?
Well, so we can see, I mean, if you think of the world in terms of matter, energy, and information, right? They're the essence of our physical world. And they're essentially the inputs into our production system. What's happening is that we're changing the way in which we can manipulate them. We're going from this system of kind of extraction and exploitation based on scarce resources to one of creation, right? One that builds up the things we need from the individual building blocks, the molecules, the photons, the electrons that are available locally in abundance. So if we look at the food system, for instance, we look at, say, livestock farming, we produce the protein we need essentially by growing animals, growing plants, and breaking them down into the products that we need. When we move to this new system, we start with a single molecule or a single cell using technologies such as precision fermentation or cellular agriculture, where we can grow individual cells into much, much kind of larger products. So we can make a steak by starting with a single cell or a single set of cells. precision fermentation allows us to hack microbes to produce the proteins that we need. So they're totally different technologies based on very limited inputs. They just need small carbohydrate sources to essentially power the reactions and to grow those foods. So they're far more sustainable, far less impactful. I mean, livestock farming's had huge impact on our physical world. Right, 70% of our farmland, right, is used for growing animals, either providing the feed for them or providing the pasture land for them to feed. So it's been an incredibly degrading and impactful technology, you know, over centuries. I mean, it's responsible for much of the deforestation we see. It's responsible for a huge amount of the greenhouse gases we see in the atmosphere, a lot of the runoff, a lot of the chemicals that have got into our system and so on. So all kinds of environmental problems that come from that. You know, as we see a transformation of that system coming, all those problems go away, right? Far less impact. But what's driving this is just the incredible improvement in technology, right? In human knowledge that we apply to make the things that we need. And you know, those technologies are going down these incredible cost curves, right? So precision fermentation, which is one of the key technologies in disrupting livestock, you know, has been going down a cost curve now for 30 or 40 years, right? From you know, the first kind of kilogram of protein, human insulin, that we made back in the early 1980s through this methodology, through this process, cost about $1 billion per kilo, right? We're now producing proteins at well under $100 per kilo, right? And we're on track by mid-decade to produce them at, say, $10 per kilo, which is about competitive with bulk proteins. Right? And then we'll continue beyond it, right? Those kinds of those cost curves are, you know, my partner Tony talks about being like gravity. They continue almost indefinitely. And so, you know, as that happens, there's nothing livestock can do, right, to compete with these new forms of food production. It's kind of like a horse, you know, trying to compete with a motor car. You just can't design a faster horse quick enough or evolve a faster horse quick enough to compete with the car, right? So there's nowhere to go. So there's an inevitable disruption coming. Now, that could be terrifying and scary, right? We could think about all the job losses that come with that, all the farming communities that will be transformed through this. Okay? Or it could be hugely empowering, right? We see the cost of food dropping dramatically. We see it moving from an inflationary paradigm based on scarce resources to a deflationary paradigm based essentially on these technology cost curves, right? We see secure, resilient, distributed food supplies. Everywhere in the world will be sort of self-sufficient in food production. We'll localize our supply chains. We'll localize the production of food. Much more resilient, robust system with far less impact on the environment. Be decarbonized. You know, no other greenhouse gas emissions either, far less impact on all kinds of ecosystems. So, you know, there are huge benefits that come through this transformation, right? But we don't often see them because we don't understand the scale of change. Same's happening. We talked about, you know, that's really matter materials we'll be able to make as well. You know, the same's happening in the energy system, that same transformation from this paradigm based on scarce inputs, based that kind of drives the centralization, the command and control structures that we see in our current system, to this massively distributed system, right, where you have very low physical flows through the system. So energy, for instance, once you've built a clean energy system, which again is the lowest cost system, the reason we build it is because it makes economic sense. We have these extraordinary cost curves as well for solar, wind and batteries. So we build this new energy system, there's no flow through that system, right? Once you've built it, you've essentially prepaid the next 30 or even 50 years of energy production, right? So there's you've essentially got a zero marginal cost system with almost no physical flows through that system. So a fundamentally different paradigm, which allows all kinds of different financing models, all kinds of different ownership structures, right? Which just don't exist in the current paradigm. And the same in information. We see, you know, with information processing and the communication of information through, say, the internet, extraordinary progress in technology. And actually, we've seen the first phase of that transformation happen. Right? We've gone from that old centralized structure where information is controlled from the center in terms of book publishing, newspapers, so on and so forth, into a world of the internet where individuals are directly connected with each other. And so we've seen that paradigm shift. But what we, you know, the problems we see in the information space are that we're still managing that system through our old kind of organizing and governance structures. And that's leading to the kind of dystopia we see in that space, right? Because essentially what you're doing when you do that is you're essentially pinning wings on the caterpillar, right? It's not a butterfly, it can't fly. So we have to, if we're to take advantage of the potential benefits that come with this transformation, we have to change what we call our organizing system, our governance structures, our institutions, and so on, to enable us to take advantage of what's coming.
And how do we do, you mentioned there's a term that they call that structural unemployment, or the idea that some individuals might either have to change jobs or may lose their jobs because the technology that the old technology that they were working under no longer exists. Of course, there has to be some type of, whether it's retraining program or something that can help those people seek employment elsewhere. But how do we have an effective messaging to those people? Because of course the horse and buggy analogy, you know, the people that ran horse and buggies, 100 plus years ago, that may have lost a job, may have had to have done something else and weren't too happy about the outcome. But of course, like you said, it was inevitable that the horse and buggy would come to an end and we would move on to vehicles. Likewise, like you said, we'll hopefully be moving to more sustainable technology, whether it's electric vehicles or so forth. But what do we do for those communities, particularly, let's say, coal mining communities and so forth, that are terrified that their entire livelihood is going to disappear or evaporate overnight?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a great question. And you know, it's kind of the heart of what we do and why we set up RethinkX. And really my answer to that is look, this is a fundamental transformation, right? And it's a transformation quite unlike other transformations we've seen, right? So in previous transformations, where we've seen industries disrupted, we've seen job losses, we've seen communities destroyed. We've seen in the new industry jobs created, and usually, you know, many more jobs created, but in different areas requiring different skills and so on. But actually, what we expect to see over the course of the next couple of decades is almost a transcendence of the production system for human labor, right? So we'll see a disruption of human labor. So the developments we're seeing in artificial intelligence and in robotics will replace all kinds of jobs, not just those kind of manual labor jobs, those jobs involved in directly in the production system, but also many of the more creative jobs, the white collar jobs, you know, the lawyers, the accountants, and so on. And that's inevitable that happens, right? We'll see that happen, and that's a terrifying thing for people in those, you know, those industries. But what we'll also see is a potential for a whole new social contract, right? We'll see the cost of all the things that we need: food, energy, transformation, housing, healthcare, and so on, also drop dramatically, right? So we have the potential of providing those needs at far lower cost, right? There are concepts like a universal basic income today, that make no economic sense. It's just too expensive to provide that for a population at anything like the kind of level required. As we move forward, we'll see that become possible. We'll see the ability to provide the things we need in a different way, right? And we'll have to think about work and reward and actually things like purpose in a totally different way. So the things we do with our time might look fundamentally different in the way that we've seen happen in many, you know, many other instances. But we'll be in a world where essentially we have our needs met, we have our time freed up, and we can think about, you know, what we do to optimize our potential to thrive in that world. But it requires a totally different conversation to the one having now. It's not simply a kind of like for like replacement of one type of job for another type of job. It's a rethinking of everything, of how we need our, you know, how we meet our needs, how and where we find purpose. So that's probably not a simple answer, but it requires a complete shift in how we think about these things.
And is this something that's going to happen on the local level, or is this going to have to happen really at the national or even international level? But what can local communities do with respect to trying to facilitate this process of disrupting unsustainable technology that's ultimately killing us?
Yeah, so I mean, the old system is centralized, so power resides at the center, right? At the national, at the kind of the state, the nation state level, and that's the old incumbency, and that's where decisions in our current system exist. But change tends to happen at the edges, right? Change is an evolutionary process; it's kind of bottom up. And it's emergent, right? And when you see transformation happen, it normally comes from the edge, right? It doesn't come from the center. You see in technology, in Silicon Valley, for instance, you know, thousands of entrepreneurs running all kinds of experiments, and the best ones win out and spread. And that's the same kind of thing we think will happen in, you know, at a societal level, that we'll have to have, you know, in individual communities and individual regions, the kind of experimentation to work out and develop the winning systems. So it is a kind of bottom-up emergent process. But the problem we have is that we have an incumbency that represents the old system that will just hang on, that will cling on to power, that has an incumbent mindset, has an inability to kind of conceive of something fundamentally different, that has incentive structures based within the old structure. So we've got this difficult period of transformation where the old system is inevitably collapsing as it gets outcompeted by the new, but the old power structures and decision-making processes kind of hang on and cling on. And my hope really is that we find, you know, communities and regions prepared to take the leap, to build these new systems, to experiment, to understand in a kind of evolutionary process. And I'm sure that will happen. It will be very, you know, it'll be painful and it'll be difficult at the center, but we'll see some winning solutions emerge. So there's a lot that communities can do, but it requires embracing a whole new model, being open to change, welcoming it even, and doing what it takes to make the kind of adaptations necessary to survive.
That's really, oops, let me start that again. I just heard an echo. That's really fascinating stuff. Do you believe that this is going to require some significant input from Congress or here in the States or from the United Nations? And I want to get your thoughts on the UN because it's obviously come under a lot of criticism in terms of how rapidly or lack thereof it's kind of reacting with respect to climate change. But do you believe that this is something that is going to require something either the national or international level really to get going, or is this something that can happen as a result of voluntary action taken by people in terms of their spending habits and so forth, or is this something that's going to just happen naturally on its own without government intervention?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, our argument would be that that the job of government through this process is to create the conditions in which that evolutionary process can happen, right? So they need to create the ability for the new system to emerge, to kick off that cycle of kind of creativity, of entrepreneurialism, of investment, of you know, consumer demand changes that drive the kind of changes we see. So we need to create the conditions in which that can happen. And there are some principles that governments can follow, you know, to open up markets, to allow, to remove regulation, to remove the support for the incumbency that allows, you know, that change to happen. Because, you know, and until the new systems scale, right, governments can crush them, right? They have the power. They have the power to resist, to, you know, to ban some of these new foods, or perhaps to resist the kind of, or at least create a more dystopian version of the old, or to make it the whole process, you know, much more painful. In terms of kind of multinational global structures, you know, they're just, you know, in many ways powerless. They don't have the kind of power that that national governments or nation states have, and our view is very much that, you know, we won't get some kind of global agreement at, you know, at the speed and at the scale that we need. That I think if we take one of the problems that you've been referencing, I mean climate change, I think there's a kind of perception, a kind of in the conventional thinking, that it's a kind of it's almost a Sisyphean task that we face. We have a massive boulder sitting at the bottom of a hill, and our job is to use all available force to push this massive boulder up the hill, and that, you know, the higher we get up the hill, the steeper and harder it gets. So we need, you know, we need tax, and we need regulation, and we need behavior change, and we need technology breakthroughs and miracles in some ways, and we need, you know, huge amounts of investment, and we have to mobilize, you know, every tool at our disposal to, you know, to make it happen. That it's on governments, right, to make the changes. Our view is it's a totally different situation. It's actually the inverse of that, that we have a, you know, essentially a snowball sitting on top of that hill, and the role of government is to get it going, to give it the initial push. Right, to give it that impetus to start rolling down the hill, to gather pace. And that as it rolls down the hill, the role of government is to keep it on track, to make sure it doesn't crush things as it tumbles down that mountain, to make sure that it doesn't cause a kind of collateral damage. And so it's a very different mindset. It's a very different way of thinking. And I think that's a challenge. You know, in many ways, we see this as a race to the top. Right, we see this huge opportunity in transforming your economy to this new model, right? To transform your food system, to transform your energy system, to transform your transportation system, for instance, your healthcare system. There's a huge prize for those those countries or those regions that lead, that go first, that make the transformation economically and socially and actually geopolitically. But right now we see it as a kind of high cost, difficult thing to do. And I think it's, you know, it's a carrot and the stick. And I think we're using the stick, and that stick is, you know, when we don't see an alternate reality, it's extremely difficult because every possible solution looks like a bad one. You know, it looks like that we have to accept higher cost or a worse quality of life or more instability. That's not the case at all. You know, we can win across all those categories if we make the transformation. And so our hope very much is that we'll find cities or smaller regions that will actually make this transition, that will see the opportunity, see the possibility, see the benefits of making this transition, and that they'll lead and others will follow and copy eventually because they have to keep up.
We only have about a minute left. Really great information. Can you tell us, of course, people can visit RethinkX.com, or you can just Google RethinkX to visit your website. But could you tell us, give us a kind of a Cliff Notes version of what they might find there and how they can educate themselves as to the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so right now, I mean, we have a series of reports that we've published. We have a book called Rethinking Humanity that's available on the website. Everything's freely available to download from the website. So we have sector reports, transport, energy, food. We have a report on some of the implications of all this change. So looking at climate change, for instance, we're working on a number of other reports in that series. Rethinking Humanity, the book, is about the civilizational scale change, and about the possibilities that emerge as we move out of one system into another. And so there's a lot of reading. Tony, my co-founder, has a number of videos that you can find on the website, which are great watching, which give a little bit more detail. And over the course of the next year, we'll be producing, you know, many more formats to communicate our ideas. So we're working hard on videos and podcasts and those kinds of things that allow us to address all kinds of issues and hopefully change the debate around a number of issues that we think we have kind of problematic ways of thinking about.
Well, excellent. Well, definitely check that out. And James, thank you so much for a great conversation today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Again, check them out at RethinkX. Check us out at mobilize.news. Thank you so much again, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are accepting applications for an engagement coordinator. The engagement coordinator is responsible for sharing KBOO's mission and values across a variety of social media platforms. They also share content created by volunteers and co-sponsors. We are looking for individuals who have skills writing marketing copy and creating and editing graphic and multimedia content. To apply, send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight Sunday, June 4th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information, go to kboo.fm/engagement-hire.
Ayo.